Jessie closed her fingers over its rounded edge, feeling two notches in it. Cigarette parking spaces. She gripped the ashtray, drew her hand back as far as she could, then brought it forward again. Her luck was in, and she snapped her wrist down at the instant the handcuff chain snubbed tight, like a big league pitcher breaking off a curve. All of this was an act of pure impulse. The missile sought for, found, and thrown, before she had time to ensure the failure of the shot, by reflecting on how unlikely it was that a woman who had gotten a D in the archery mod of her 2-year college phys ed requirement could possibly hit a dog with an ashtray, especially when the dog was 15 feet away and the hand she was throwing with happened to be handcuffed to a bedpost. Nevertheless, she did hit it. The ashtray flipped over once in its flight, briefly revealing the Alpha Gamma Rho motto. She couldn't read it from where she lay and didn't have to. The Latin words for service, growth, and courage were inscribed around a torch. The ashtray started to flip again, but crashed into the dog's straining, bony shoulders before it could roll all the way over. The stray gave a yip of surprise and pain, and Jessie felt a moment of violent, primitive triumph. Her mouth pulled wide, in an expression that felt like a grin and looked like a screech. She howled deliriously, arching her back and straightening her legs as she did. She was once again unaware of the pain in her shoulders, as cartilage stretched and joints which had long since forgotten the limberness of 21 were pressed almost to the point of dislocation. She would feel it all later, every move, jerk, and twist she had made. But for now she was transported with savage delight at the success of her shot, and felt that if she did not somehow express her triumphant delirium, she might explode. She drummed her feet on the coverlet and rocked her body from side to side, her sweaty hair flailing her cheeks and temples, the tendons in her throat standing out like fat wires. "Ha!" she cried. "I got you! Ha!" The dog jerked backwards when the ashtray struck it, and jerked again when it bounced away and shattered on the floor. Its ears flattened at the change in the bitchmaster's voice. What it heard now was not fear, but triumph. Soon it would get off the bed and begin to deal out kicks with its strange hard feet. The dog knew it would be hurt again, as it had been hurt before if it stayed there. It must run. It turned its head to make sure its path of retreat was still open, and the entrancing smell of fresh blood and meat struck it once more as it did so. The dog's stomach cramped, sour and imperative with hunger, and it whined uneasily. It was caught, perfectly balanced between two opposing directives, and it squirted out a fresh trickle of anxious urine. The smell of its own water, an odor that spoke of sickness and weakness instead of strength and confidence, added to its frustration and confusion, and it began to bark again. Jessie winced back from that splintery, unpleasant sound. She would have covered her ears if she could, and the dog sensed another change in the room. Something in the bitchmaster's scent had changed. Her alpha smell was fading while it was still new and fresh, and the dog began to sense that perhaps the blow it had taken across its shoulders did not mean that other blows were coming after all. The first blow had been more startling than painful, anyway. The dog took a tentative step toward the trailing arm it had dropped, toward the entrancingly thick reek of mingled blood and meat. It watched the bitchmaster carefully as it moved. Its initial assessment of the bitchmaster as either harmless, helpless, or both might have been wrong. It would have to be very careful. Jessie lay on the bed, now faintly aware of the throbbing in her shoulders, more aware that her throat really hurt now, most aware of all that, ashtray or no ashtray, the dog was still here. In the first hot rush of her triumph, it had seemed a foregone conclusion to her that it must flee, but it had somehow stood its ground. Worse, it was now advancing again, cautiously and warily, true, but advancing. She felt a swollen green sack of poison pulsing somewhere inside her. Bitter stuff, hateful as hemlock. She was afraid that if that sack burst, she would choke on her own frustrated rage. "Get out or I'll kill you. I don't know how, but I promise to God I will." The dog stopped again, looking at her with a deeply uneasy eye. "That's right. You better pay attention to me," Jesse said. "You just better, because I mean it. I mean every word." Then her voice rose to a shout again, although it bled off into whispers in places as her overstrained voice began to short out. "I'll kill you. I will. I swear I will. So get out." The dog, which had once been little Catherine Sutland's prince, looked from the bitchmaster to the meat, from the meat to the bitchmaster, from the bitchmaster to the meat once more. It came to the sort of decision Catherine's father himself would have called a compromise. It leaned forward, eyes rolling up to watch Jesse carefully at the same time, and seized the torn flap of tendon, fat, and gristle that had once been Gerald Burlingame's right bicep. Growling, it yanked backward. Gerald's arm came up. His limp fingers seemed to point through the east window at the Mercedes in the driveway.
"Stop it!"
Jesse shrieked. Her wounded voice now broke more frequently into that upper register where shrieks became gaspy falsetto whispers.
"Haven't you done enough? Just leave him alone!"
The stray paid no heed. It shook its head rapidly from side to side, as it had often done when it and Kathy Sutland played tug-of-war with one of its rubber toys. This, however, was no game. Curds of foam flew from the stray's jaws as it worked, shaking the meat off the bone. Gerald's carefully manicured hand swooped wildly back and forth in the air. Now he looked like a band conductor urging his musicians to pick up their tempo. Jesse heard that thick, throat-clearing sound again, and suddenly realized she had to vomit.
"No, Jesse!"
It was Ruth's voice, and it was full of alarm.
"No, you can't do that. The smell might bring it to you. Bring it on you."
Jessie's face knotted into a stressful grimace as she struggled to bring her gorge under control. The ripping sound came again, and she caught just a glimpse of the dog. Its forepaws were once again stiff and braced, and it seemed to stand at the end of a thick, dark strip of elastic the color of a ball jar gasket, before she closed her eyes. She tried to put her hands over her face, temporarily forgetting in her distress that she was cuffed. Her hands stopped still at least 2 feet apart from each other, and the handcuff chains jingled. Jesse moaned. It was a sound that went beyond desperation and into despair. It sounded like giving up. She heard that wet, snotty ripping sound once more. It ended with another big, happy kiss smack. Jesse did not open her eyes. The stray began to back toward the hall door, its eyes never leaving the bitchmaster on the bed. In its jaws was a large, glistening chunk of Gerald Burlingame. If the master on the bed meant to try and take it back, it would make its move now. The dog could not think, at least not as human beings understand that word. But its complex network of instincts provided a very effective alternative to thought, and it knew that what it had done, and what it was about to do, constituted a kind of damnation. But it had been hungry for a long time. It had been left in the woods by a man who had gone back home whistling the theme from Born Free, and now it was starving. If the bitchmaster tried to take away its meal now, it would fight. It took one final look at her, saw she was making no move to get off her bed, and turned away. It carried the meat into the entry and settled down with it caught firmly between its paws. The wind gusted briefly, first breezing the door open and then banging it shut. The stray glanced briefly in that direction and ascertained in its doggy, not quite thinking way that it could push the door open with its muzzle and escape quickly if the need arose. With this last piece of business taken care of, it began to eat. The urge to vomit passed slowly, but it did pass. Jessie lay on her back with her eyes pressed tightly shut, now beginning to really feel the painful throbbing in her shoulders. It came in slow, peristaltic waves, and she had a dismaying idea that this was only the beginning. "I want to go to sleep," she thought. It was the child's voice again. Now it sounded shocked and frightened. It had no interest in logic, no patience for cans and can'ts. "I was almost asleep when the bad dog came, and that's what I want now, to go to sleep." She sympathized wholeheartedly. The problem was she didn't really feel sleepy anymore. She had just seen a dog tear a chunk out of her husband, and she didn't feel sleepy at all. What she felt was thirsty. Jessie opened her eyes, and the first thing she saw was Gerald, lying on his own reflection in the highly polished bedroom floor like some grotesque human atoll. His eyes were still open, still staring furiously up at the ceiling. But his glasses now hung askew, with one bow sticking into his ear instead of going over it. His head was cocked at such an extreme angle that his plump left cheek lay almost against his left shoulder. Between his right shoulder and right elbow, there was nothing but a dark red smile with ragged white edges. "Dear Jesus," Jessie muttered. She looked quickly away, out the west window. Golden light, it was almost sunset light now, dazzled her, and she shut her eyes again, watching the ebb and flow of red and black as her heart pushed membranes of blood through her closed lids. After a few moments of this, she noticed that the same darting patterns repeated themselves over and over again. It was almost like looking at protozoa under a microscope, protozoa on a slide which had been tinted with a red stain. She found this repeating pattern both interesting and soothing. She supposed you didn't have to be a genius to understand the appeal such simple repeating shapes held, given the circumstances. When all the normal patterns and routines of a person's life fell apart, and with such shocking suddenness, you had to find something you could hold on to, something that was both sane and predictable. If the organized swirl of blood in the thin sheaths of skin between your eyeballs and the last sunlight of an October day was all you could find, then you took it and said thank you very much. Because if you couldn't find something to hold on to, something that made at least some sort of sense, the alien elements of the New World Order were apt to drive you quite mad. Elements like the sounds now coming from the entry, for instance. The sounds that were a filthy, starving stray eating part of the man who had taken you to see your first Bergman film. The man who had taken you to the amusement park at Old Orchard Beach, coaxed you aboard that big Viking ship that swung back and forth in the air like a pendulum, then laughed until tears squirted out of his eyes when you said you wanted to go again. The man who once made love to you in the bathtub until you were literally screaming with pleasure. The man who was now sliding down that dog's gullet in gobs and chunks. Alien elements like that. "Strange days, pretty mama," she said. "Strange days indeed." Her speaking voice had become a dusty, painful croak. She supposed she would do well to just shut up and give it a rest. But when it was quiet in the bedroom, she could hear the panic, still there, still creeping around on the big soft pads of its feet, looking for an opening, waiting for her to let down her guard. Besides, there was no real quiet. The chainsaw guy had packed it in for the day, but the loon still voiced its occasional cry, and the wind was rising as sunset approached, banging the door more loudly and more frequently than ever. Plus, of course, the sound of the dog dining on her husband. While Gerald had been waiting to collect and pay for the sub sandwiches at Amato's, Jessie had stepped next door to Michaud's market. The fish at Michaud's was always good, almost fresh enough to flop, as her grandmother would have said. She had bought a lovely filet of sole, thinking she would pan broil it if they decided to stay overnight. Sole was good because Gerald, who would live on a diet of nothing but roast beef and fried chicken if left to his own devices, with the occasional order of deep-fried mushrooms thrown in for nutritional purposes, actually claimed to like sole. She had bought it without the slightest premonition that he would be eaten before he could eat. "It's a jungle out there, baby," Jessie said in her dusty, croaky voice, and realized she was now doing more than just thinking in Ruth Neary's voice. She actually sounded like Ruth, who in their college days would have lived on a diet of nothing but Dewars and Marlboros if left to her own devices. That tough, no-bullshit voice spoke up then, as if Jessie had rubbed a magic lamp. "Remember that Nick Lowe song you heard on WBLM when you were coming home from your pottery class one day last winter? The one that made you laugh?" She did. She didn't want to, but she did. It had been a Nick Lowe tune titled, "She Used to Be a Winner, Now She's Just the Doggie's Dinner," a cynically amusing pop meditation on loneliness set to an incongruously sunny beat. Amusing as hell last winter, yes, Ruth was right about that, but not so amusing now. "Stop it, Ruth," she croaked. "If you're going to freeload in my head, at least have the decency to quit teasing me." "Teasing you? Jesus, Tootsie, I'm not teasing you. I'm trying to wake you up." "I am awake," she said querulously. On the lake, the loon cried out again, as if to back her up on that. "Partly thanks to you." "No, you're not. You haven't been awake, really awake, for a long time. When something bad happens, Jess, do you know what you do? You tell yourself, 'Oh, this is nothing to worry about. This is just a bad dream. I get them every now and then. They're no big deal. And as soon as I roll over on my back again, I'll be fine.' And that's what you do, you poor sap. That's just what you do." Jessie opened her mouth to reply. Such canards should not go unanswered, dry mouth and sore throat or not. But Goodwife Burlingame had mounted the ramparts before Jessie herself could do more than begin to organize her thoughts. "How can you say such awful things? You're horrible! Go away!" Ruth's no-bullshit voice uttered its cynical bark of laughter again, and Jessie thought how disquieting, how horribly disquieting it was to hear part of your mind laughing in the make-believe voice of an old acquaintance who was long gone to God knew where. "Go away? You'd like that, wouldn't you? Tootsie, wootsie, pie, daddy's little girl. Any time the truth gets too close, any time you start to suspect the dream is maybe not just a dream, you run away." "That's ridiculous." "Is it? Then what happened to Nora Callaghan?" For a moment, that shocked Goody's voice. And her own. The one that usually spoke both aloud and in her mind as "I." To silence. But in that silence, a strange, familiar image formed. A circle of laughing, pointing people, mostly women, standing around a young girl with her head and hands in stocks. She was hard to see because it was very dark. It should have still been full daylight, but was for some reason very dark just the same. But the girl's face would have been hidden even if the day had been bright. Her hair hung over it like a penitent's shroud, although it was hard to believe she could have done anything too horrible. She was clearly no more than 12 or so. Whatever it was she was being punished for, it couldn't be for hurting her husband. This particular daughter of Eve was too young to have even begun her monthly courses, let alone have a husband. "No, that's not true." A voice from the deeper ranges of her mind suddenly spoke up. This voice was both musical yet frighteningly powerful, like the cry of a whale. "She started when she was only 10 and a half. Maybe that was the problem. Maybe he smelled blood just like that dog out in the entry. Maybe it made him frantic." "Shut up!" Jessie cried. She felt suddenly frantic herself. "Shut up! We don't talk about that!" "And speaking of smells, what's that other one?" Ruth asked. Now the mental voice was harsh and eager. The voice of a prospector who has finally stumbled over a vein of ore he has long suspected but never been able to find. That mineral smell, like salt and old pennies.
"We don't talk about that," I said.
She lay on the coverlet, her muscles tense beneath her cold skin, both her captivity and her husband's death forgotten, at least for the time being, in the face of this new threat. She could feel Ruth, or some cut-off part of her for which Ruth spoke, debating whether or not to pursue the matter. When it decided not to, not directly at least, both Jesse and Goodwife Burlingame breathed a sigh of relief. "All right, let's talk about Nora instead," Ruth said. "Nora, your therapist? Nora, your counselor? The one you started to go see around the time you stopped painting because some of the paintings were scaring you. Which was also the time, coincidentally or not, when Gerald's sexual interest in you seemed to evaporate and you started sniffing the collars of his shirts for perfume. You remember Nora, don't you?"
"Nora Callaghan was a prying bitch," the good wife snarled.
"No," Jesse muttered. "She was well-intentioned. I don't doubt that a bit. She just always wanted to go one step too far. Ask one question too many."
"You said you liked her a lot. Didn't I hear you say that?"
"I want to stop thinking," Jesse said. Her voice was wavery and uncertain. "I especially want to stop hearing voices and talking back to them, too. It's nuts."
"Well, you'd better listen just the same," Ruth said grimly, "because you can't run away from this the way you ran away from Nora. The way you ran away from me, for that matter." "I never ran away from you, Ruth!"
Shocked denial, and not very convincing. She had done just that, of course. Had simply packed her bags and moved out of the cheesy but cheerful dorm suite she and Ruth shared. She hadn't done it because Ruth had started asking her too many of the wrong questions. Questions about Jesse's childhood. Questions about Dark Score Lake. Questions about what might have happened there during the summer just after Jesse started to menstruate. No, only a bad friend would have moved out for such reasons. Jesse hadn't moved out because Ruth started asking questions. She moved out because Ruth wouldn't stop asking them when Jesse asked her to do so. That, in Jesse's opinion, made Ruth a bad friend. Ruth had seen the lines Jesse had drawn in the dust, and had then deliberately stepped over them anyway, as Nora Callaghan had done years later. Besides, the idea of running away under these conditions was pretty ludicrous, wasn't it? She was, after all, handcuffed to the bed.
"Don't insult my intelligence, cutie pie," Ruth said. "Your mind isn't handcuffed to the bed, and we both know it. You can still run if you want to. But my advice, my strong advice, is don't you do it. Because I'm the only chance you've got. If you just lie there pretending this is a bad dream you got from sleeping on your left side, you're going to die in handcuffs. Is that what you want? Is that your prize for living your whole life in handcuffs ever since..."
"I will not think about that!"
Jesse screamed at the empty room. For a moment, Ruth was silent. But before Jesse could do more than begin to hope that she'd gone away, Ruth was back. And back at her, worrying her like a terrier worrying a rag. "Come on, Jess. You'd probably like to believe you're crazy rather than dig around in that old grave. But you're really not, you know. I'm you. The good wife's you. We're all you, as a matter of fact. I have a pretty good idea of what happened that day at Dark Score when the rest of the family was gone. And the thing I'm really curious about doesn't have a lot to do with the events, per se. What I'm really curious about is this. Is there a part of you, one I don't know about, that wants to be sharing space with Gerald in that dog's guts come this time tomorrow? I only ask, because that doesn't sound like loyalty to me. That sounds like lunacy. Tears were trickling down her cheeks again, but she didn't know if she was crying because of the possibility, finally articulated, that she actually could die here, or because for the first time in at least 4 years, she had come close to thinking about that other summer place, the one on Dark Score Lake, and about what happened there on the day when the sun went out. Once upon a time, she had almost spilled that secret at a woman's consciousness group, back in the early 70s, that had been. And, of course, attending that meeting had been her roomie's idea. But Jessie had gone along willingly, at least to begin with. It had seemed harmless enough, just another act in the amazing tie-dyed carnival that was college back then. For Jessie, those first 2 years of college, particularly with someone like Ruth Neary to tour her through the games, rides, and exhibits, had been for the most part quite wonderful. A time when fearlessness seemed possible and achievement inevitable. Those were the days when no dorm room was complete without a Peter Max poster, and if you were tired of the Beatles, not that anybody was, you could slap on a little Hot Tuna or MC5. It had all been a little too bright to be real, like things seen through a fever which is not quite high enough to be life-threatening. In fact, those first 2 years had been a blast. The blast had ended with that first meeting of the Women's Consciousness Group. In there, Jessie had discovered a ghastly gray world which seemed simultaneously to preview the adult future that lay ahead for her in the 80s and to whisper of gloomy childhood secrets that had been buried alive in the 60s. But did not lie quiet there. There had been 20 women in the living room of the cottage attached to the Newworth Interdenominational Chapel, some perched on the old sofa, others peering out of the shadows thrown by the wings of the vast and lumpy parsonage chairs, most sitting cross-legged on the floor in a rough circle, 20 women between the ages of 18 and 40-something. They had joined hands and shared a moment of silence at the beginning of the session. When that was over, Jessie had been assaulted by ghastly stories of rape, of incest, and of physical torture. If she lived to be 100, she would never forget the calm, pretty blonde girl who had pulled up her sweater to show the old scars of cigarette burns on the undersides of her breasts. That was when the carnival ended for Jessie Mayhoot. Ended? No, that wasn't right, let alone fair. It was as if she had been afforded a momentary glimpse behind the carnival, had been allowed to see the gray and empty fields of autumn that were the real truth. Nothing but empty cigarette wrappers and used condoms, and a few cheap broken prizes caught in the tall grass, waiting to either blow away or be covered by the winter snows. She saw that silent, stupid, sterile world waiting beyond the thin layer of patched canvas, which was all that separated it from the razzle-dazzle brightness of the midway, the patter of hucksters, and the glimmer-glamour of the rides. And it terrified her. To think that only this lay ahead for her, only this and nothing more, was awful. To think that it lay behind her as well, imperfectly hidden by the patched and tawdry canvas of her own doctored memories, was insupportable. After showing them the bottoms of her breasts, the pretty blonde girl had pulled her sweatshirt back down and explained that she could say nothing to her parents about what her brother's friends had done to her on the weekend her parents had gone to Montreal, because it might mean that what her brother had been doing to her off and on all during the last year would come out. And her parents would never have believed that. The blonde girl's voice was as calm as her face, her tone perfectly rational. When she finished, there was a moment of thunderstruck silence, a moment during which Jessie had felt something tearing loose inside her, and had heard 100 ghostly interior voices screaming in mingled hope and terror. And then Ruth had spoken. "Why wouldn't they believe you?" she demanded. "Jesus, Liv, they burned you with live cigarettes. I mean, you had the burns as evidence. Why wouldn't they believe you? Didn't they love you?" Yes, Jesse thought. Yes, they loved her, but... Yes, the blonde girl said. They loved me. They still do. But they idolized my brother Barry. Sitting beside Ruth, the heel of one not quite steady hand resting against her forehead, Jesse remembered whispering, "Besides, it would have killed her." Ruth turned to her, began, "What?" And the blonde girl, still not crying, still eerily calm, said, "Besides, finding out something like that would have killed my mother." And then Jesse had known she was going to explode if she didn't get out of there. So she had gotten up, springing out of her chair so fast she had almost knocked the ugly, bulky thing over. She had sprinted from the room, knowing they were all looking at her, not caring. What they thought didn't matter. What mattered was that the sun had gone out, the very sun itself. And if she told, her story would be disbelieved only if God was good. If God was in a bad mood, Jesse would be believed. And even if it didn't kill her mother, it would blow the family apart like a stick of dynamite in a rotten pumpkin. So she had run out of the room and through the kitchen, and would have belted right on through the back door, except the back door was locked. Ruth chased after her, calling for her to stop. "Jesse, stop." She had, but only because that damned locked door made her. She'd put her face against the cold, dark glass, actually considering, yes, just for a moment she had, slamming her head right through it and cutting her throat. Anything to blot out that awful gray vision of the future ahead and the past behind. But in the end, she had simply turned around and slid down to the floor, clasping her bare legs below the hem of the short skirt she'd been wearing, and putting her forehead against her upraised knees and closing her eyes. Ruth sat down beside her and put an arm around her, rocking her back and forth, crooning to her, stroking her hair, encouraging her to give it up, get rid of it, sick it up, let it go.